Right, so the title, what was my title? A Deformation Invariant. Of 1 plus 1b sq of t's. And this is based on two papers. Which are both with Davide. But the archive references are 1902.10249, which is joint with Davide and Edward Witten. And 1904.05788, which is also joint with Davide. Maybe that's the only thing I'm going to look at this paper for. So the general question that I think lots of people have thought about that these papers are exploring, there's a general question that you might ask, which is, a version of what is the, you can ask various variations of it, but the type of question I have in mind is, say, what is the topology of your favorite space? Of quantum field theories. And by topology, I might mean something fairly coarse. I might mean, for instance, I might mean that homotopy theory and the first question, the basic question that you could ask in a version of this that, and you know, I'm asking it kind of quite generally. You might have some favorite class of quantum field theories, your favorite dimension, a favorite number of supersymmetries or whatever. But the even more basic question you could ask is the most basic question. That you could ask is kind of when can two field theories be related? When can two of your favorite quantum field theories be related by some sort of deformation? So that's the type of question I want to explore, and the specific version I want to explore for this talk and that we were looking at in these works was the case of 1 plus 1 dimensional quantum field theories with minimal supersymmetry. So for this talk. Minimal, which is also called 0, 1, supersymmetry. And there's, of course, lots of techniques by now that people know for how to study this type of problem and show, for instance, that two field theories might not be related. So the most basic invariant that people know about is an invariance of, is sort of a, lots of versions of anomaly matching. So an example of a technique is if two theories are related, or whatever, I mean, I haven't defined deformation, but whatever deformation equivalent means, then certainly they have the same anomalies. Whatever those are. That's the type of answer you might use to tell that theories are in different components, the space of quantum field theories. I didn't organize that at all. So let me mention this just slightly more in the 1 plus 1 dimensional case. So for instance, in the case I care about of minimally supersymmetric 1 plus 1D theories, so for 1 plus 1 dimensional quantum field theories, for instance, There's a gravitational anomaly. Which you could think of as, so at least in the, so the statement I'm going to make is that this anomaly is well defined. I'll write a formula that doesn't look like it will compile in general, but the gravitational anomaly is, well, I'll write it as, say, c right minus c left. So this is, this formula is if we're a conformal field theory. But the claim is that this actually, this number is always a well-defined number for any quantum field theory, which has this expression in the conformal field theory case. You know, if you flow, if you sort of, if you're not a conformal field theory and you flow, there's all of these invariants we know about, the same logic of C functions and stuff, which do change. But I claim this difference doesn't change. This difference is in a half Z. So that's the type of thing I have in the back of my mind. So already we see that the space of 1 plus 1 dimensional field theories breaks into a bunch of components indexed by this gravitation. OK, maybe a little bit more specific for the type of question I really want to ask, which is an example of this type of question that you might care about. So let's fix, let's give in some 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory. In this case, let's say. Yeah, so let me just give myself a name before I continue, sorry. I'm going to start writing, say, I'll write SQFTN for the space of quantum field theories of the field theories I care about. 1 plus 1D minimally supersymmetric quantum field theories with gravitational anomaly N up to the factor of two. So that way I can just start referring to. So then another type of question you could ask is you could fix a field theory here. So given a field theory of some fixed gravitational anomaly. See, the gravitational anomaly doesn't have anything to do with the supersymmetry. But when I deform, I want to stay in the space of supersymmetric field theories. Given a field theory with some fixed gravitational anomaly, that's like the first thing you compute about it. Now you might want to ask all sorts of physics questions about it. Some questions you could ask, some natural questions, include, for example, is supersymmetry spontaneously broken? This is a question lots of people want to know, be able to know the answer to. A slightly more general question you could ask is, does your field theory admit a small deformation? Such that after doing the small deformation, supersymmetry is spontaneously broken. And now I can come back to the case I really care about, which is sort of a notion of deformation equivalence. So I want to ask sort of does, maybe can F be connected by some path in the space of quantum field theories. So one in which supersymmetry is spontaneously broken. So these are three levels of the analysis that I want to study. And just to kind of complete to really connect these up, I want to just say what do I really mean by deformation equivalent. So when I say connected by some path, this would maybe be the same as saying deformation equivalent to one. And to make clear what I really mean by that, I mean that just to be completely explicit, I mean that two field theories, what I want to imagine, this apology I want to imagine. On this space is called the topology, is what I'm going to call the topology of deformation equivalence. Is I might say that two theories, I want to say this, let me say it this way. Two theories are deformation equivalent first of all, if you can just do a usual Hepth deformation, if you sort of add an operator, and if they're related by usual Hepth deformation, you add an operator. That's certainly an example of deformation equivalence that I want to consider. Another example of deformation I want to consider is that two theories at different scales should certainly be considered equivalent. And then I want to make this into an equivalence relation. So what I'm really imagining when I think about paths in the space of field theories is I might imagine starting at some theory, maybe deforming it a little bit. So you start at some theory, you deform a little bit, and then you flow down. And then you might find some other theory that flows to the same RJ, or same IR. And so if this theory is the same as is equivalent to this one, and this one's also equivalent, then certainly that zigzag is an equivalence. So the last type of deformation equivalence I want to do is sort of theories that have the same IR. It's the type of thing I'm picturing. So I want to give some examples of positive answers to these questions, and then I'll come back to the deformation invariant that will be a way to give negative answers.
How are you distinguishing 2 and 3? Does 2 mean like all? It's broken for all small, like you have a parameter you're taking to 0 and it's broken for all.
You might have a theory that has a small deformation, a parameter that, like, right, a deformation just by a little bit, so that after you nudge it a little bit, it already flows to, it already has spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. And it might not, like, that's a priori stronger than saying that maybe you can flow down to something and then flow up to something else and then flow down to something. Like that's like sort of symmetry breaking in one flow.
Okay.
Right? Spontaneous supersymmetry breaking is already about like what base is like a question about the far IR of your theory. It's about the vacuum. And so the difference between 2 and 3 is whether you can do it just in one flow or in a zigzag. Yeah, so let me now give some examples. So this will be sort of an extended example. Which is I want to consider as my example, and this will be a running example for the rest of the, I guess, the remaining 45 minutes. You could consider the 0 comma 1 sigma model. Remember, I'm doing 0 comma 1 supersymmetry. And I might take the target to be the round S3. That's the running example I'm going to have. Well, this what I've written on the board is not enough to define the physical model yet. So the aficionados will know that to write down a sigma model with some target, I need to not just tell you a metric, but I also need to tell you some sort of what you might call a B field. So to make sense of the model, to make the model well defined, to give an actual sigma model, I need to choose what you might call a quantum B field which is some explicit object. And it always happens for any target manifold that you might pick. Also need to choose a spin structure and so on, because there's some fermions in the game. The space of these is always the case. So the one I'm going to use, I'll write S3K for the sigma model, where with the B field of which I want to say this, where the B field has H units of a this B field has kind of strength K, has K units of H flux. K here is just an integer. And I just wanted to make a comment about this, actually. What I wrote here is totally nonsense. So I just want to make an aside that in general, for a general n, a general manifold, to give the quantum sigma model, because I have minimal supersymmetry, see what's happening is that the minimal supersymmetry means that I have an unmatched number of left and right moving fermions. And each of those fermions introduces an anomaly, and the B field is some anomaly cancellation information. And so for general M, there might actually just be an obstruction to writing down the sigma model. To the existence of any sigma model, of a 0-1 sigma model. And if the obstruction vanishes, which it does in the S3 case, in general, the B field doesn't live, the B field itself lives in a torsor for H3 of the manifold, which in this case is a Z. But it doesn't actually live in H3. In the S3 case, this torsor is trivialized, canonically trivialized. So that was sort of an aside for people who care deeply about anomaly cancellation data. Yeah. This is the example I want to study in the, I'm going to come back to in the talk. So this, the way I've said it is I have a sigma model. You know, it's not a conformal object or anything. Sigma models typically are not conformal when you quantize them. And you could ask, what is the far IR limit? Of this theory. What does it look like in the IR? And we have a pretty good guess for the answer. So the answer is, it's actually a really interesting answer, so I wanted to tell you about it, is that when, so how would you answer this question? Well, there's sort of standard techniques by now for answering this type of question that involves sort of you write down all the symmetries you can see, you try to write down a possible IR limit that has those symmetries and with the appropriate anomalies. And the answer in this case, and I'm putting it up so that I can reference it later, is that well, if k is positive, say k is not zero, then in the IR it turns out that what you find will flow to a 0,1 WZW model, for the group SU2. The 0,1 WZW model has, on the sort of the left moving operators are just some bosons in G, so it has a bosonic level, and then the right moving operators have some bosons and some fermions. So the levels are, the left moving level is the absolute value of k minus 1. And the right moving level is the absolute value of k plus 1. That's if k is not 0. And If k equals 0, then we're pretty sure that the answer is that this has spontaneous supersymmetry break. So that's an example. I wrote it up to give an example of number one. So I'm telling you that exactly for one value of k, does this family of interesting theories have satisfied number one? But I also wanted to use this to give an example of number three. So as an example of number three, I want to consider the following situation. So this is a sort of continuation of the example. So I'll even write it up. So example number three that I want to tell you about is the following. So you could imagine taking a K3 surface. The K3 surface is an example of a manifold which sort of actually does have an obstruction. There is no minimally supersymmetric sigma model that targets the K3 surface. You're going to have a 1-1 sigma model, but not a 0-1 sigma model. But that's OK. Instead, I will take the K3 surface and I'll subtract a point. And I'll take that point and put it very far off at infinity. So I want to think of this. Here's my cartoon of a K3 surface. You know, in all manifolds look like tori. So here's my picture of a K3 surface minus a point. And this is a cylindrical n. So the neighborhood of that point looks like an S3, or rather like an S3 times r. So here's the puncture. At an infinity. And it turns out that this non-compact manifold is a valid target for a 0-1 sigma model. This is a valid target. For a 0-1 sigma model. And it's valid only in one way, because the ways of choices that you could make is some torsor for something, which ends up being trivial. So it's a valid target in just a unique way. And now what I can imagine doing is the following. Oh, see, I lied somewhere. I should have said this earlier on. Well, it's OK. So this is a non-compact manifold. The space of quantum field of some non-compact quantum field theories tends to be really big, and it's pretty pretty wishy-washy. It's pretty easy to move around the space of non-compact theories. So to give this an interesting question, I really should have used the space of compact quantum field theories. Compactness, I don't have a precise definition for, but it's of the form a condition on the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. That's how you should think of compactness. So, I don't have a precise definition in 2D, but I can tell you what compact means for quantum mechanics models. So compact means, compactness is a spectral condition on the Hamiltonian. So if you think about if you ask yourself, what is the difference between a quantum theory built on a compact manifold and a non-compact manifold? The non-compact manifolds have continuous spectrum, and the compact manifolds have discrete spectrum. And not just discrete, but discrete and not piling up at infinity so much. So this is a valid target for a non-compact sigma model. And and do the following. See, what I'm going to do, though, is I'm going to use the fact that near the puncture, that a slice of this looks like an S3 at a slice. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a function on this. There's a function. I'll call it, I don't know, phi, which is the just down to the real numbers. And I'd like to modify my model to force myself onto fibers of phi. And the way I can do that is I can, for any number, say any x down here, something I can do is I can take my K3 sigma model. I can take the K3 sigma model, this K3 minus a point sigma model. And as I said, what I want to do, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to force to be on a specific value of this function. So the way that I'll do it is I'll add a Lagrange multiplier. So I'll take the K3 sigma model, I'll turn on a left moving fermion. And this is going to be a Lagrange multiplier. And then I'll modify the Hamilton. I'll turn on a superpotential, which is like. And the result of this procedure is that the theory you produce when you do this is a theory that looks very much like the fiber of the map phi. This is a quantum way of taking the fiber of the map.
Six.
Oh, sorry, that's right. It's a quantum way of taking the fiber at x of the map phi. The Lagrange multiplier, this whole construction forces phi minus x to be zero, basically. And the result is that at least when x is very large, so now this whole thing, this is actually now a family of theories of SQFTs. Depending on this parameter x. And the result is that when x is very large, the fiber of this is, as I said, it's an S3. And it turns out that it's an S3. So it turns out that when x is very large, let's call this family, I don't know, F sub x. Turns out that when x is very large, f sub sort of plus infinity just ends up being an S3 sigma model. It looks like a sigma model would target the fiber. And it's specifically, it's a topology calculation to compute what B field you see. It turns out it's an S3 sigma model with B field of strength 24. 24 units of H plus. On the other hand, when x is very small, the fiber of this map is nothing at all. And so this theory, this is not really true. These are not really equal, but they have the same IR. They're like, anyway, this one can sort of flow to that one. And when x is very small, then this theory has spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. Because the fiber's empty. And so the end result is that this K3 surface minus a point gives an example of a path of theories that starts at the theory with 24 units of H flux and ends at the theory with no units of H flux. I mentioned these anomalies, by the way. I should have just written them up. So the S3 sigma model or any sigma model has C right minus C left equals 3 halves. SQFT 3. And that matches. This had a 4 halves, and then I added a fermion.
It seems to contradict this recent tension point.
Sorry?
But over here, you have that S324 goes to something else.
Right, so I'm saying that S324 does not have spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. It doesn't flow to anything trivial. It really is a non-trivial theory. but I can nevertheless connect it by a path. So to, if you try to run this path, like I wrote, I described a path for you in the kind of at finite scale in the UV. You could ask fiber by, as you move along this path, what are the IR limits of these different paths? And if you ask that question, you'll see some complicated zigzag in the space jumping from IR limit to IR limit. Anyway, so an example of number three. I somehow, number two I care less about, although lots of people care about it. An example of number three is S3 with 24 units, or in fact any multiple of 24. So there's some examples of theories that do have spontaneous supersymmetry breaking or that can be connected to something which has spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. Another question you might want to know is sort of, can you forbid a theory from having spontaneous supersymmetry breaking? Can you, if I give you some theory, is there some calculation you can do to show that it does not have spontaneous supersymmetry?
Argument apply for any target space, actually. You just take the target space and say the particle directs this real axis.
Yeah, that's right. So more generally, what I've just secretly showed you was I showed you that if you have two manifolds, which are cobordant, if you have a cobordism of manifolds, and if that cobordism is compatible with these B fields, then the corresponding sigma models are connected by a path. In fact, this is an important point. So I'll even write it up. So, so what this argument shows more generally, so the mathematician's name for manifolds up to cobordism is M. And the mathematician's name for the type of cobordism which corresponds to this sigma model of this type of B field is called M string. So M string N is the space of N manifolds with this quantum B field modulo cobordisms of N manifolds. And what this argument shows you is that this space maps to the space of sigma, by taking a sigma model, this maps to the space of SQFTs of gravitational anomaly N modulo deformations. Modulo deformation equivalence. So sometimes you have a theory and you want to show that it has these properties and then you just do it, for instance, in the cases I showed you. Sometimes you want to show that a theory does not have these properties. Sometimes you want to protect. A quantum field theory from, say, solving any of these. So, how would I protect a field theory from having property three? Well, one of the things I could do is I could give you a deformation invariant. Well, the answer is I give you a deformation, find a deformation invariant. Deformation invariant, which let's call, I don't know, how do you protect some specific quantum field? Yeah, which you find a deformation invariant, which is zero if supersymmetry is spontaneously broken, and not zero in your theory that you care about. Then that would certainly rule out the possibility of being deformation equivalent to one with supersymmetry spontaneously broken. And then you'd have to actually be able to do the computation. And there's a very famous example of a deformation invariant like this. It's the most famous example. Is what goes variously called the elliptic or Witten genus. The elliptic genus has various descriptions, but the most sort of straightforward one is to say that it's just given an SQ of t, I could ask you what is the, I could compute the elliptic genus is just the partition function. Of f on tori with non-bounding spin structure. Odd spin structure. That's the definition I'll use. So I'll write it as z of f, and I'll record that the spin structure is non-bounding in both directions by saying it's Ramon-Ramon, meaning Ramoned in both directions. So it's Ramoned in this direction, and it's Ramoned in that direction. Okay, and now I can come back to this issue with compactness. So if you're very badly non-compact, then this partition function doesn't even make sense. So for this partition function to be a well-defined thing, I need some amount of compactness. I'm using this to define the elliptic genus. And I'll use it again and again and again. Because the point I want to make I want to remind some facts about this elliptic genus. So there's sort of, and these I'm hoping are just very standard facts that you've hopefully seen before. So there's some standard facts I want to remind. First of all, from the beginning, I was telling you it's a deformation invariant. And again, I'll keep flagging that this really uses compactness. But the other two facts I want to remind about this that are even maybe more primitive facts about this invariant are the following. So the first fact is that, so I said this was the partition function on tori with non-bounding spin structure. So now you could ask, what's that a function of? How many tori are there with non-bounding spin structure? Let's say on flat tori with non-bounding spin structure. So a flat torus with non-bounding spin structure, to tell you a flat torus with non-bounding spin structure, I have to tell you it as a conformal object. So the space of these has three real dimensions. I have to tell you the conformal geometry of the torus, let's say the ratio of A and B cycles. So that's there's some sort of holomorphic parameter tau and its complex conjugate tau bar. And then there's also the overall volume of the torus. I'm not in a conformal field theory, so the volume might, a priori functions are allowed to depend on the volume. And a priori, this partition function is only real analytic. That's why I've written two variables. So a priori, say a priori, this partition function is a function of three variables. Three real variables. It's a priori, it's real analytic. It is a priori SL2Z invariant. So it's a priori a function of three variables, and it's SL2Z modular, just because I set it in terms of a torus. But the main fact number one that I want to tell you is that, in fact, although it's a priori a function of three variables, in fact, it's actually only a function of one variable. So there's no actual tau bar or volume dependence. I will review why this is true, because it'll matter in the next thing I'm about to say. So let me explain, let me remind you why fact number one holds. Why does one hold? It's a standard argument. I look at my partition function. I look at, say, for instance, let me just do this one. So I look at z d tau bar, and it's always true that if I want to deform in the tau bar direction, if I want to take my world sheet and change some parameter, some geometric parameter on the world sheet, that's the same as inserting a stress energy tensor. This is the one-point function of the T z-bar stress-energy tensor, component of the stress-energy tensor. And I'll just be a little sketchy, but the idea is that this is that because I have a supersymmetry, this is actually a Suzy exact. So this is actually the supersymmetry acting on the z-bar component of the, of itself.
Does that follow from some general principle?
It's the definition of minimal supersymmetry. This is general principle.
I mean, Suzy algebra only tells you that H and P are like appear in the algebra, right? Not TZZ, TZ or similar.
I think I said it right. I think I said it right. I think this is basically H minus P or something like that.
You have to integrate that to get the charge.
Yeah, I mean, I'm. There's all sorts of integrals that I was supposed to put in. And this is a like.
I don't want my function to the space of the constant. Some integral stuff needed. I mean, some normalization needed at the constant.
Yeah. So there's some normalizations. Backslash prop 2. In any case, the point is that, in the non-bounding spin structure, the expectation of the supersymmetry acting on anything is always zero. But that's special to the non-bending spin structure. And again, it's special to compact theories. Let me try to do it in detail. And if I wanted the volume term, I would have used the ZZ bar term instead. The last basic fact that I want to review is, so I have a modular, what was a priori real analytic modular object is in fact a holomorphic or a weakly holomorphic modular object. And so I can take its Q expansion. And the last fact I want to mention is that the Q expansion of this function is integral. And the reason for this the The reason for this is that you can compute this partition function. Rather than putting your manifold on a torus all at once and asking what is the partition function, I can do it by first putting it, by compactifying it on an A cycle down to a one-dimensional theory by first compactifying on an S1 with non-bending spin structure, and then recognizing that the result is a supersymmetric quantum mechanics model. Recognizing specifically that ZRR is the index in the sense of quantum mechanics of this quantum mechanics model. And in fact, this parameter Q, this ends up being counting, this is corresponds to rotating the circle that you compactify along. So I'm hoping these are standard facts. If they're not, I can try to explain them more, but okay. So this invariant ends up letting you compute things. So there are lots of examples of field theories that you can write down and compute and find that they have a non-trivial elliptic genus, and therefore they cannot be related to one with supersymmetry spontaneously breaking. But this invariant, it only goes so far. So just for degree reasons, I should have said this is, it's a priori real analytic modular, but it's also holomorphic. So this is a weakly holomorphic modular form. I'm lying to you, I'm leaving out some normalization. But it's a weakly holomorphic modular form, which up to some normalizing factor of some power of eta, it's a weakly holomorphic modular form of weight C right minus C left.
So what's weakly?
Meaning that it's allowed to blow up at the cusp. Up to some normalizing factor, it's a weakly holomorphic modular form of some specific weight. And there aren't any modular forms except for certain weights. So this invariant's just zero a lot of the time, just for stupid reasons. So for instance, this invariant is just zero for all of the sigma models I told you about for the S3, because then right minus left was 3/2, and there's no modular forms of weight 3/2. That would be nonsense. So instead, I want to write down another invariant. And I erased it. But I want to go back to the case I sort of imagined before. So I want to probe these conditions, 1 and 2. And I sort of emphasize they both used compactness. And what I now want to consider is I want to now consider the following situation. Let's suppose I have some field theory Y that I care about in, let's suppose I have two field theories. So suppose I have a family of theories. A family of theories relating some theory, sort of a family of SQF, yeah. So suppose I erased it before, but suppose I have a theory that some interesting theory why. So the picture I just erased was sort of this one. And this is what I want to imagine now in general. Suppose I have some fixed field theory y, which is related to zero, or maybe related to something else. But let me say that, and a path. Connecting y to an SQFT with spontaneous to sort of spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. So, for instance, the three sphere with strings with k equals 24. It doesn't have to be a path of sigma models, but I could. What I can do is then I want to imagine assembling the path. Into a non-compact theory. Maybe I'll call it X. So the way you do that is you say, well, what is a path? A path is a theory that depends on some non-dynamical parameter, and you dynamicalize that parameter. So what does X have? You can go the other way. What X has is X has an observable. So I want to say that X has this X will have cylindrical ends. It'll sort of have boundary Y. So this X will have, you know, the other way. By the procedure I told you before. On a Lagrange multiplier. So although I erased it because I don't want to necessarily force you into sigma models, I still want to sort of, I want you to visualize this thing where out here you have theory Y as a constant family, and over here you have spontaneous supersymmetry breaking, and then in the whatever you have in the ball. So if you did have this non-compact theory X, then I can try to study. I'm going to run out of time. Great. So basically, what I'm saying is I liked the elliptic genus for compact theories. It was a useful invariant. Even if I have a non-compact theory, if I have a null deformation of a theory, that gives me a non-compact theory. So now let me use my favorite invariant, even though it doesn't apply, even though my favorite invariant is really for compact theories. So I can look at my favorite invariant. And I can look at this partition function. For this mildly non-compact, basically null deformation.
So
yeah.
Is it obvious why if the path isn't given by a family of sigma models, like how you turn the path into a non-compact SQFT?
No, but I didn't really tell you what a path was either.
You take the parameter, you make it into a field.
Yeah, I mean the short answer is you take the parameter, make it into a field, and whatever a path is in this moduli space that I haven't constructed yet, it should have the property that the parameters of paths can be promoted to fields. No, I mean, really, actually, for me, the definition of path is non-compact theory with a function that, so that when I turn on the Lagrange multipliers, I get the theory, my theory at the ends. Yeah, so we can look at this partition function of the non-compact theory. I'm not going to worry about the deformation invariance. Not even going to worry about it at all. But I want to ask about dependence on tau bar and about the Q expansion. So this partition function is automatically, as I said, it's a priori SL2Z modular, but only real analytic. So you could ask, does it actually have, say, property one? Does it actually only depend on tau? And we could try to calculate its derivative with respect to tau. We can run the same argument. It's still true that the derivative is what you get by inserting the stress energy tensor up to some normalizing factor. And it's still true that that's a sort of descendant, super descendant. And now the question is, does this vanish? And the answer is no. Instead, when you try to show that the super descendant has vanishing one-point function, what you should imagine doing is that you're doing some sort of it's a sort of a Stokes theorem statement. It's like the statement that a global derivative vanishes, the integral of a global derivative vanishes, where the integral that I'm imagining is somewhere integral in field space. And what you know when you have a non-compact thing is that, in fact, you get a boundary term. And so what we claim is that up to some normalization, the derivative in tau bar is actually the one-point function of the supersymmetry operator itself in the boundary. And there was a normalizing factor, square root of minus 8 times.
Question,
yeah.
Why do you expect Z or to be defined given it's a trace? And
great question. My answer is that this theory is only very mildly non-compact. But also, actually, sort of to set this up correctly, I should have required that my theory Y here. So I think I'm going to do this. I'm going to be able to win by only doing the story with certain constraints. So let's, in particular, ask the theory Y have vanishing elliptic genus already. And now, there was some integral that was here, but if this is at least very zero, then that integral should converge. In particular, if y has degree 3, then I think this will still work, just for degree reasons. But no, it is something about whether, you know, you're right that I should worry.
Can you tunnel the potential of this x, which was promoted to field, so that's...
Yeah, but so what I have in this direction is it looks like I have sort of y, which is compact. But then in this direction, it looks like I have a non-compact boson.
Yes.
And you could worry that a
potential in that direction.
Not and still have boundary y. The whole thing is I want that non-compact boson direction for what I'm about to do. No, you should worry. But the answer is that the contribution of the partition function from this end looks something like the partition function of y times the partition function of a non-compact boson, which is infinite. But if this is sort of more zero than that is infinite, then I think I'll still be OK. Sorry?
That is certainly true of quantum mechanics, and I won't come back to anything.
Yeah.
The fibers.
So I'm going to run out of time, so I better finish. So, and there's a similar formula for the, I mean, this is really the kind of the GZ bar component. There's a similar formula for the, though we think for the volume dependence. And I claim that so it's not holomorphic anymore, but it has a specific holomorphic anomaly. So that's the version of statement one for this mildly non-compact theory. And I'm leaving out factors of Dedekind zeta function that are just normalizations. And the version of statement two so because this is a not a holomorphic function anymore, you could worry, what do I mean by the Q expansion at all? Let me write, from now on I'm going to write f hat of tau bar for this. And I'm going to just leave out any mention of the volume anymore because I don't want to deal with it. Yeah, that's right. So if y is conformal, then the derivative in the volume direction is the one-point function of sort of the other components of the supersymmetry, which is just zero. And so there's no volume dependence. So what you can do is you can define, if you have a non-holomorphic object that you want its Q expansion, you can just take it sort of by fiat. You can define the holomorphic part to be the limit as tau bar goes to minus I infinity of the whole thing. Now you have a holomorphic function, but this limit breaks modularity. But it's still a sort of well-defined holomorphic. Now it's, but now it only has one parameter, so I can take its Q expansion. But this guy has a Q expansion. And the version of 2 prime is that its Q expansion of f of tau is integral. Well, actually, it's not quite integral. It's some explicit thing correction having to do with the Atiyah-Podolyi-Singer eta function. There's two different things called eta functions. But this is usually zero. So don't worry about it. And so now, can I have a minute more? So summarizing what I told you, is I told you the following. I told you the following. I told you that if y is deformation equivalent, so given y, I can do the following. I can look at the function g of tau tau bar, which is the one-point function. Let's say this is a CFT, just for convenience, the one-point function of the supersymmetry operator. I can explicitly solve the holomorphic anomaly equation. And then, so then what I'm telling you is that then, that if y is sort of null homotopic, I mean, if it can be deformed, null deformable, then there exists f hat of tau tau bar solving first this holomorphic anomaly equation, and integral with integral Q expansion. So rearranging this, I could say, what does G determine F? Well, G does not quite determine F. But see, G determines the class of F. See, it doesn't determine F, but it determines the class of F up to holomorphic things. It determines the class of F as an element in real analytic modular forms, modulo holomorphic modular forms. And so this determines the class of F of just this piece as a class in Q expansions of modulo holomorphic modular forms. And what I'm telling you is not that this class is zero, but that it's integral. So I'm telling you that the further class of F in analytic and Q expansions modulo modular forms plus integral modular forms vanishes. I'm saying that if Y is null homotopic, then this specific class, which really only depends on the one-point function, only depends on y, is zero. And conversely, you can run the argument in reverse, and what you find out is that this class in this group even if you didn't have this null homotopy part, this class is a deformation invariant of y. And now I can finish with the sigma model case that I started with, and then I'll end, which is that for S3K, or rather for the WZW model that we study, this class is minus k on 24. It's equal to the class minus k on 24.
you say that? Is that going to be times E2 or something?
Yeah, it's like minus, it's the 24 is a G2, yeah, minus KG2 or something, or maybe KG2. You know, plus holomorphic modular or integral. And so in particular, it has, for instance, S3, see, G2 starts on 1 on 24. It's not integral, and the rest of it is integral. So in particular, S3, say, with k equals 1, is not null deformable. Ah, great. Time to stop. Thank you.
Thank you for a great talk. Any questions?
For this one?
Yeah.
So what happens is, I don't actually compute it for the sigma model. I lied. I shouldn't have said for S3K. I really should have said for the WZW model. So let me remind you what this WZW model looks like roughly. So the basic fields in the WZW model are, I have some, so the basic fields in the WZW, there's a copy of the bosonic WZW, the full bosonic WZW for SU2 at level k minus 1. And then there's also three right moving fermions. So this is kind of, there's a J and a J bar. And then there's three right-moving fermions. And it turns out that you can write down explicitly the supersymmetry generator. And it's, I think, the square root of 2, 1, k plus 1. Maybe there's a factor of I that I'm leaving out. I'm not sure. And then the product of the three fermions. And then something which is some constant multiple that I don't remember the constant of, times something about the fermions and the bosons. J psi I type flavor. And so then the one-point function, well, this will have trivial one-point functions. So I didn't have to remember this. So the one-point function, this is just 0. And so the one-point function is, well, it's the one-point function of this part, which is basically a eta of tau bar cubed. And then there's the one-point, then there's the just the partition function of the bosonic theory, because I still have the bosonic theory lying around. The partition function of the bosonic WZW, which you can look up explicitly. And so we have a nice explicit formula, and I can even get some, because these constants matter, I can get the constants right. Still this constant. And I don't know how much you want me to write it out, but I could just like copy from our paper the explicit formula. And then the point is that actually, Harvey, Murphy. So all I want to flag about this is that this bosonic WZW theory, its partition function is a dot product, is the length squared of a vector-valued modular form. So this is some, there's some vector-valued modular form, which is the chiral, the conformal blocks of the theory. Of length squared. And so the holomorphic anomaly equation, any tau dependence will just commute through. And so what I really have is a vector-valued modular form just in tau bar, which is this eta cubed and then that the tau bar piece of that. And Harvey, Murphy, and Nazaroglu had been very interested in solving holomorphic anomaly equations with specific vector valued modular forms as the answer. And so they give an explicit formula. So they give an that. And then there's more computation to get the Q expansion.
Any other questions?
David, did I do that right?
So if there's no question, let's thank him again.